We're going to start by talking about what happened last night. So last night, I believe it was a little after midnight Central Time, so it was maybe 1 a.m., 2 a.m. Eastern Time, the U.S. and Israel launched a joint strike on Iran. And many people saw this coming. It was pretty clear. Based on the military buildup in the Middle East, the deployment of two aircraft carriers, the USS Gerald Ford and the Abraham Lincoln, over a dozen destroyers, you had 50% of the U.S. deployable air power in the Middle East at the time that the conflict broke out. In addition, the United States and Israel had made steps to bolster their defenses. They deployed missile defense systems like Patriot missile batteries and THAAD systems. The U.S. moved its troops out of harm's way, called on diplomatic personnel at embassies to evacuate. Israel opened bomb shelters. So it was very clear, as you know, that since those protests in January, about a month and a half ago, when the United States moved to deploy all this military power in the region, that we were moving towards war. And last night, we finally got it. And so the U.S. and Israel launched, I believe now the tally is over 1,000 airstrikes on Iran. It appears that the U.S. and Israel have suffered no casualties. They have complete air superiority over the western half of the country. They claim they will have air superiority over the rest of the country within 24 hours. The U.S. and Israel targeted regime targets, so centers of government, command and control, military leadership, fortified bunkers. They also targeted nuclear sites, and that's not just Fordo, Esfahan, and Natanz, which is where they enrich the uranium, but also Bushehr, where Iran operates a Russian-provided nuclear power plant. And lastly, they targeted, and this is the big one, regime military assets. So missile launch platforms, their missile manufacturing cities, where they actually have underground an entire city to build their missiles. The U.S. targeted their Navy, targeted their defense ministry, their intelligence ministry, the executive function of the military, and all the hardware. Very shortly after the strikes began, and rumors surfaced of this on social media, video was posted, the president made a statement. And I have to tell you, this was the most disturbing, surreal thing I think I've witnessed maybe since the COVID pandemic. And if you saw this live, you know what I'm talking about. The president posted a formal address last night announcing the operation and discussing the goals of the operation and some expectations about what will happen. And he announced it wearing no necktie, in a baseball cap that says USA, in front of a black curtain by himself. And without getting too much into this quite yet, because we will arrive there eventually, there is something particularly surreal when you measure and weigh the gravity of the situation and its significance for the United States. Obviously, the United States has been involved in the Middle East for a very long time, doing exactly this sort of thing. Regime change, proxy warfare, fighting terrorism, ostensibly, deploying massive amounts of air, sea, and ground power. And the entire conceit of this MAGA movement of President Trump, the whole reason we're doing this, nominally, this was supposed to be in opposition to the Iraq war and to the legacy of the Iraq war and all of the other associated interventions. Now, we know that the same people that were behind the war in Iraq, they're the same people that have been beating the drum for war in Iran for just as much time. And they have tried to pressure many presidents into doing this, and they have moved the United States closer to a conflict like this. And so Trump, being the one who was supposed to challenge and oppose all of this, who repudiated it and created this successful political movement, now to be delivering for the same people, repudiating those people and their agenda, for him now to be serving them, delivering for them what they have wanted for so long, number one on their wish list. It's actually disturbing. It's disturbing what it says about how our country works, whether we, the people, are still in control. Is this a government of, by, and for the people? Do elections matter? Does the popular will matter in our representative democracy, in our republic? If we vote to repudiate a policy, a foreign interest group, a special interest group, repudiate a particular agenda, and we get that agenda anyway, that war, those people, regardless, what does that say about the political state, the actual true political reality of the United States of America? If anything, it just verifies what Trump said from the very beginning, which is that we are no longer in control. The people are no longer sovereign. And we knew that. That is something that we had always known and we had always suspected. This is confirmation. This is an illegitimate regime. The Constitution, representative democracy, our republic is effectively over. You can vote for a candidate that repudiates the global war on terror, the war in Iraq, regime change, someone that explicitly promises not to bring us into new conflicts. Someone that explicitly campaigns as the peace president, no new wars, and you'll get all of it anyway. We are in a state of distress. This is not a republic anymore. That's over. And the MAGA movement is surely dead, of course. But anyway, I digress. I watched the speech last night, very uncanny and disturbing and strange. And you need to listen to the speech because the speech lays out exactly what this is. Trump talks about the entire history of U.S.-Iranian relations. He goes back to the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis, to the Beirut barracks bombing in 1983. He discussed Iran's use of IEDs and their backing of Shiite militias in Iraq. What is the purpose of all of this? What is the purpose of all of this history? Well, he is making the case, as they say. He is making the case, creating the pretext for a regime change war in Iran. And the message is simple. The Iranian regime, obviously Iran is going nowhere. The territory, the population, they're not going anywhere. But this regime, which was thrust into power during the revolution in 1979, Trump is making the case that they are an international pariah, a threat to the United States, an historic adversary of the United States, and therefore, that is why they have to go. So make no mistake about it, that rhetoric that he lays out in the beginning of the speech, that's a regime change speech. He is laying out the case. This is why the regime has to go. That's not a speech about nuclear weapons, missiles. It's not a speech about bringing them to the negotiating table. Obviously, that's a regime change speech. Further, he makes it even more explicit. He announced the targets of the strike. He said that the United States and Israel launched a joint operation targeting Iran's Navy, its missile production facilities, and regime targets. He called upon the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Iranian Armed Forces to lay down their arms or they would die. He then said that upon the conclusion of the operation, he invites the Iranian people to emerge from shelter and to take their country back. He effectively said, I am giving you the opportunity. I am neutralizing the Iranian government and its military and the regime. And once we're finished, you will emerge and take back your country. And so every aspect of this speech is critical. He is making the case that the regime must be toppled, talking about destroying all of the regime's assets, killing all of their personnel, calling for a complete and total surrender. And in the end, after all that, calling upon the Iranian people to rise up, have a coup, and install a new regime. So again, make no mistake about it, we have entered into a regime change war. Now, why am I saying this? Why is this such an important thing to understand? We have been at war with Iran for decades. We have been in a state of war with Iran by every other means. We have assassinated their leaders. The Israelis have assassinated their scientists. With Israel, we have launched cyber attacks on their infrastructure, not just nuclear, but also other vital critical infrastructure. There has been espionage, industrial sabotage. We have gone to war with their proxies, like the Houthis in Yemen. We have launched strikes against their positions in other countries too. We have been in a state of war for a long time. But because the objectives of these other operations have been limited, people don't call it a war. They say these are operations to neutralize the nuclear program, or this is meant to increase our leverage in negotiations, or it's some form of a proxy war, and this is about rolling back their soft or hard influence across the region. Well, tonight, nobody can deny we are now engaged against Iran in a full-fledged regime change war. Now, what's more, as we discussed for the past couple of weeks, everybody suspected that we would eventually use this military power that is forward deployed against Iran. The question concerning that operation is what the goal of that would be and how it would be accomplished. Now, this matters very deeply because the kind of force that has been deployed into the region, as you have probably noticed, is a naval force and an air force. And that is the operation. It is a naval and an air operation. We have not invaded Iran. We have not put boots on the ground. We don't have special forces there. There has not been a major coalition invasion. We don't have people parachuting in. How this operation is being conducted is with missiles launched from ships and with air power. It is with our carriers, which bring the air power to the region. It is with bombers, which have been stationed in other countries. It is an air and sea campaign. Now, this creates a conundrum here, because again, if the goal is the maximalist objective, which is to topple the Iranian regime, we are going all the way. Again, it's not about degrading their capabilities. It's not about weakening them. If the goal is to exterminate the Iranian regime, we're going all the way and toppling them. It raises the question, how is that going to be done with air and sea power alone? We now have the goal. We also now have the mode. We know what the Trump administration is seeking, and we know how they seek to achieve it. But the problem that is created is that historically, you cannot achieve a regime change through air and sea power alone. Why is that? Because although you can bomb civilian government facilities, you can bomb military facilities, you can destroy the Navy, you can destroy hardware, anti-aircraft systems. On the other side of all of the bombing, there are still going to be 200,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps soldiers, and they will be armed. On the other side of this, you are still going to have, all in, about 1 million Iranian security personnel between the IRGC, the Iranian Armed Forces, and the internal security forces. You can decapitate, you can cut off the head of the snake, you can kill some or half or all of the regime, you can blow up all of their major weapon systems. But on the other side of the bombing campaign, there will be a country of 90 million people, and the only apparatus in place to control those people with the use of force that is organized into a hierarchy behind an ideology with some semblance of legitimacy, with experience, it's going to be the very same Iranian regime. This is the problem. Blow up their navy, destroy their missiles, decapitate the leadership. There's a chain of command. Other people will replace the leadership. And again, destroy the big weapons. The small weapons are still in the hands of the army. And unless you actually have an alternative invading force, whether that is a U.S. ground invasion, an invasion from a neighboring state, whether you have proxies from inside the country, sectarian groups, separatist groups, anti-government groups, unless there is an alternative force that is armed, that is numerous, that is organized and is able to communicate. And unless that group has legitimacy and can earn the support of the country, well, all things considered, on the other side of the conflict, the most likely successor to the Iranian regime is the Iranian regime. It may not be the exact same people, but it will be the same security apparatus. And so this is the big conundrum here. We have deployed all the air and sea power. We've launched the operation. And by all appearances, we are winning this war. By all appearances. But appearances can be deceiving. If you watch the news, they report that there have been over 900 airstrikes, that the U.S. and Israel have air superiority in most of the country. We control the airspace. We have assassinated the Ayatollah, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. We have assassinated some of the top military and civilian government leadership. We have probably, by the end of this, will have destroyed their entire navy, all of their missiles, all of their missile production facilities, and so on. And this is the operation. It appears that we are winning. People are saying this is a great success. And they say that perhaps the American public and the world will get with the program and rally behind this when they see the outcome, when they see the effectiveness of it. But that is where we stand under 24 hours into the operation. Where will we be when the bombs stop dropping? Where will we be in a week? I want to get into this article from the Wall Street Journal. We'll just read through this and talk about some of the details. And we'll talk a little bit more about what has happened in the past 24 hours. Then we'll get into some of the timeline, how we got here, and then answering this question where we're going. So this is from the Journal. It says, quote, President Trump and Israel launched attacks on Iran with the ambitious aim of bringing down the regime in Tehran, a goal that promises heavy use of force and which will rattle Gulf allies concerned about a wider regional war and instability on their doorstep. U.S. and Israeli forces went hard at Iran beginning early Saturday, attacking Iran's leaders and symbols of the regime, in addition to military assets that Iran would need to fight a war. Heavy strikes were expected to continue for days. Israeli strikes focused on high-value officials and Iran's missile capabilities, while the U.S. attacks went after military targets. In a speech posted on Truth Social, Trump said the strikes are weakening Iran's rulers and called on Iran's people to take the opening as a once-in-a-generation chance to topple the regime. He said, quote, when we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. America is backing you with overwhelming strength and devastating force. Now is the time to seize control of your destiny and to unleash the prosperous and glorious future that is close within your reach. This is the moment for action. Don't let it pass. Now fighting for its survival, the Iranian regime launched a wave of missile attacks on U.S. military bases in some Gulf states, as well as on Israel. Iranian missiles are headed towards bases in Bahrain, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates. They've also been launched against Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraqi Kurdistan, and Israel. U.S. officials haven't yet outlined a plan for who would take control of Iran in the event that the regime falls, or how to avoid a chaotic power struggle among factions within the Iranian regime and its divided opposition. So this is what you need to understand about the dynamic here. And this is very important. We have to understand the security situation between Iran, Israel, and the United States. Israel has been principally concerned with Iran's nuclear program, its proxies, and its missiles. Now, more on this in a moment. We'll get back into this equation here. This war, unlike last year, is specifically focused on Iran's missiles. Last year, the U.S. and Israel took out Iran's nuclear program. We destroyed their biggest centrifuge facilities. We apparently made their stockpile of highly enriched uranium inaccessible. Arguably, we set back the program several years, and we increased Iran's breakout time from when they might decide to make a nuclear weapon to when they acquire one from weeks to possibly years. And so we neutralized that deterrent capability of Iran. In this war, we're going after their missile program. Iran has built thousands of ballistic missiles, which are being intercepted as we speak, but if launched in a surprise attack in large enough volleys, may not be able to be intercepted. And so this is the only military capability that Iran has to defend itself. Its air defenses, its air force, its navy are completely inferior to the United States and Israel. However, it is their mass production of cheap ballistic missiles, and they source components from China and Russia, and they're making hundreds of them all the time. It is this massive stockpile and capability to mass produce missiles which truly threatens Israel and the United States. If Israel and the United States engage in operations, and you're seeing it today, Iran can launch missiles, and not all of them, but a small percentage can actually strike at Israeli and American civilian or government sites. And this is the only capability that Iran has. That's sort of their only resort if Israel and America attack. So the purpose of this war, what Trump said specifically in the speech, is to destroy their capability to make missiles and destroy their missile stockpiles. Now, this gives us some clues here, because again, when you think about the kind of force that is deployed in the region and the goals, it doesn't work. We're bombing the big stuff, but in 4 days, in a week, in 2 weeks, when this is all over, who is at this point the most likely contender to take power? It's not going to be the Iranian people, because the Iranian people are not organized. They're not armed. They don't have backing from a superpower patron, or at the minimum, coordinating with them on the ground. Have to assume some of that is happening, but we haven't seen any real movement take hold, least of all in the protests last month. So the people cannot spontaneously get together and form a new government. If that's the case, then in a week or 2 weeks' time after the bombs start dropping, the only force that is even capable of picking up the pieces, of enforcing any semblance of order in the country, will be the same security apparatus as before. It's going to be the Revolutionary Guard. It's going to be the armed forces. It's going to be the besieged. Now, perhaps the Trump administration is counting on the survivors of this attack being more pliable. Very similar to Venezuela. What did Trump do in Venezuela? Well, he picked up Maduro, and the vice president, the second in command, just filled his spot. We didn't even necessarily destroy their entire military. We didn't destroy their armed forces. We killed about 100 palace guards, Cuban intelligence, and Venezuelan security forces, kidnapped Maduro in the hopes that the successor, who was a part of the same apparatus, would be more open to negotiating. And they see what happens to the president. They see what the United States is capable of. And they realize that you can't win this one. Your defensive capabilities will not work. You cannot inflict pain on the United States. It is utter domination. You are crushed. And so the choice of the vice president is you're either going to go the way of Maduro and die or be imprisoned, or you're going to find a way to work with the United States. And that's the model. And it is telling that these two operations have happened so close to one another. It was just not even 2 months ago that the United States pursued a faux regime change in Venezuela. Is it a true regime change? Well, the entire security apparatus remains in place. The Chavista government remains in place. It is Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's vice president, who now rules the country with the same defense minister, the same intelligence minister. So it's a decapitation without a regime change. It's a form of persuasion, aggressive negotiations. We took your leader and now we've left you with no options. Perhaps this is the formula in Iran. Decapitate the regime, kill the Ayatollah, kill the top IRGC commanders, make them vulnerable and defenseless, remove hope from the equation. Without a navy, without missiles, without their high-ranking security personnel, they must realize they are completely vulnerable. They are completely defenseless and completely open. Is that perhaps the calculation? That whoever, whether it's the second, third, fourth, fifth guy in the chain of command, whoever survives, when that person rises above, maybe it's some other faction or element in the security services whoever survives and claims to speak for the remnant of the Iranian regime, maybe the Trump administration is counting on that person simply being willing to negotiate. And you leave the internal security apparatus in place. You don't go like you did in Iraq and put them all on trial and kill all of them and de-bathify them, re-educate them and reintegrate them or something like that. But you simply swap out an obstinate leader with a more pliant leader, and you work on a new understanding where the Iranian regime can cooperate with the United States. Now, here are the problems with this way of thinking. Again, you're not going to remove an entrenched regime with air and sea power alone. The Trump administration knows that. The Department of War knows that. They know that if they really wanted to replace all these people, they would need a rival security service, political faction, and nothing of that sort exists. There are people that oppose the regime. There are other claimants to rule Iran, but none of them have the necessary support. None of them have the necessary organization or weapons. So it looks very unlikely that, again, any force other than a remnant of the Iranian security apparatus will rule afterward. And you have to expect that the Trump administration knows that. And so perhaps this is the expectation. They will pound Iran, hit them so hard, again, make them utterly defenseless so that there is not even the delusion, there is not even the myth that Iran is going to be striking a carrier with a hypersonic missile, that Iran is going to destroy Israel with thousands of missiles in a huge volley. And they will have to come to terms and negotiate with the United States on our terms. Well, here's the problem with this way of thinking. Famously, Tucker Carlson challenged Ted Cruz, who was in favor of an operation like this, and said, how many people live in Iran? And Ted Cruz had no idea. And he dismissed that and said, that's trivia. That's a trivial detail. What does it matter how many people live there? Well, it actually matters quite a bit, because a country three times the size of Iraq, with 90 million people and a million soldiers, is not actually going to be subdued by bombs. What happens the day or the week after Iran's military is utterly destroyed? Well, probably chaos breaks out. Probably people are going to try to flee, and the borders are going to destabilize. Probably people are going to rush to the stores and try to stock up on essentials, which will cause the economy to effectively collapse. There will be looting. There will be chaos. There will be a lapse in critical infrastructure, public services. You're looking at the bottom falling out from the country. And that will actually create a vacuum. It will actually embolden and buttress the Iranian security force, because there will be a need for order and only that force will be able to provide it. What's more, here's the other problem with this. So Iran's security force is going to be there. Attacking Iran, bombing all their cities, killing potentially hundreds, maybe thousands of civilians. What effect does that have on the resolve of Iranians and of the Iranian political leadership? If it's a remnant of the Iranian security forces, who is to say that these people, the survivors who just watched their friends, colleagues, leaders, spiritual figures get murdered in a war of aggression, who is to say those people are now going to roll over for the United States? Perhaps that works in Venezuela, a much smaller country in terms of territory and population, ruled over by corrupt people with no real ideology, not religious zealots, not even particularly nationalistic, maybe not even ideological anymore, but just plutocrats, just crony socialists or something. Maybe that works in Venezuela, where they're more worried about their personal enrichment or survival. But in Iran, a regime that is literally created by religious police, secret police, a vanguard revolutionary paramilitary with an eschatological opinion and interpretation of their own country and its role in the future of the universe, who is to say that the remnant of that security service is not going to be more hardcore than what came before? Who's to say that they will not be more emboldened and their resolve won't be hardened after the strikes. And maybe they don't negotiate then. So what happens the day after? Obviously, then this remnant, whether they're in favor or against the United States, they will seek to rebuild. Just as the Iranian regime after Midnight Hammer began to rebuild the nuclear infrastructure and their missile capability, you have to imagine that the remnant of the Iranian security forces is going to try to rebuild also. It may be a much taller order and basically impossible, but we have to entertain the scenario, maybe the most likely scenario, that hardliners come to power. They retain control of the country rather than an uprising of the people. And they go to work building more missiles in the military. So what does the United States do then? Do they allow Iran to keep going? Do they allow Iran to rebuild and reconstitute on a long enough timeline? Maybe not in months or weeks, but over the course of many years. Obviously not. This gets back to that security equation. What was stopping Israel and the United States before from intervening in Iran? What was preventing us from doing this 10 years ago, 20 years ago? What prevented us from doing this is that we thought Iran was going to build a nuclear bomb. And if we invaded and if we tried to topple the regime, maybe before we were successful, they would have a nuclear bomb. And then they might use it. Then we're in trouble. Missiles, not a big deal. Nuclear bomb on top of a missile, that would pose a problem for Israel and the United States. So that is a deterrent that prevented us from operating in Iranian territory. But it was also their ballistic missile program. Maybe the United States wasn't willing to go in, but Israel always wanted to go into Iran. They were worried about the nuclear program, but they're also worried about the missiles, as you saw last year. When Israel forced our hand to intervene in Iran, it was Israel that had to tap out. It was they that had to plead with Washington to intervene to bring an end to the conflict because Israel was being bombarded with wave after wave of hundreds of Iranian ballistic missiles, drones, cruise missiles, and they were running out of interceptors to shoot them down. So why could Israel not intervene over Iran's skies? Because if they did, they would be bombarded with missiles and it would shut down their country. It's a very small country with not a lot of population centers, and it's hard to have commerce. It's hard to keep people there if your airports and your cities and residential buildings are being hit with hypersonic ballistic missiles. So Israel could not intervene unless the missiles were destroyed. Are you seeing where this is going? Now that Iran's nuclear hedge has been obliterated by Midnight Hammer last year and the operation today, now that its missile capacity has been severely degraded and its navy, which might be able to close the Strait of Hormuz, now Iran is truly defenseless. And what this does is it creates options for further engagement. So you might think this is the climax. This is the be all end all, just as you might have thought the climax was last year, that this is it. This is the war to topple the regime. I don't think so. I think that when we look back in history, this will be characterized as yet another operation to degrade Iran's military capabilities, just like Midnight Hammer, just like the other operations. Just like the industrial sabotage, assassinating the scientists, just like all these other operations, this is about systematically defeating in detail Iran's military so that we can open up a front against Iran in perpetuity. So in short, what happens when Iran's security force takes back control over the country and maybe it's led by a hardliner, maybe it's led by another reformer? Well, if diplomacy fails, now Israel and the United States, we can operate in Iran with impunity. If Iran doesn't play ball when this is over in 6 months, in a year, it costs us nothing to intervene. And this is the operational goal, which is to achieve the same situation in Iran as you had in Syria for 15 years. In the same way that Israel took control of Syria's skies and airspace and launched airstrikes constantly, degrading the Assad regime and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard there, Israel seeks to open up the exact same front in Iran. This is not the end. This is actually just the beginning of a new chapter. This is another operational strike to further degrade Iran's military so that there can be future operations. And the ultimate goal is the regime change. The ultimate goal, I imagine, is to eventually create a situation, either at the end of this or some other operation in the future, where through CIA and Mossad backing, Shin Bet, whoever, they are going to back a liberal democratic force, they will back some rival claimant, they will eventually replace the Iranian regime, and then that Iranian regime will be subordinated to Israel in exactly the same way as has happened to Syria and to Iraq and to other countries. I think that is the ultimate goal. And that is the situation as it stands. I think that is what is happening today. And I think that is what will happen in the immediate future. Now, I want to talk about something very specific here. We have to be precise about why we oppose this war. What we're looking at right now, it looks like a military success. Again, and appearances can be deceiving, but that is what it looks like. The U.S. and Israel are just having their way. They are dropping bombs. As far as we know, nothing has been shot down. No Americans have been killed. And although Iran has retaliated with missile strikes on the Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, even though they've launched a lot of missiles at all these countries, it doesn't seem that it's done a ton of damage. Or if there are unreported casualties, it doesn't seem they are substantial. And Iran's ability to defend itself or respond has been vastly exaggerated. There was this idea for a time that we would lose this war, that we don't know what we're in for. Operation True Promise number 72 is on its way. And this time they're serious. This time the missiles are going to hit. Everybody was saying this, that we're going to lose this war. They're going to sink a carrier. It's going to deal a psychological blow to us. It'll be a Vietnam. Well, it's leaving one part out, which is if we don't put ourselves in harm's way, we win. We move the troops out of the bases within range of their missiles and they don't die. We don't invade and drive around their country in Humvees. Nobody's getting exploded. The only ability for Iran to respond might be a false flag terror attack or a real terror attack by an Iranian cell in Europe or the United States. Outside of that, they have no real ability to hurt any strategic American targets. Now, this is something that we have to contend with, because if the Trump administration is successful, let's be honest here, if we pull this off without a hitch, let's say we destroy Iran's military and no Americans die, then that is a true miracle. That is truly impressive. If the United States confronts Iran like this, we hit them so hard and we don't lose a single plane, ship, helicopter, we don't lose a single life. And Iran, which was propped up to be this huge threat and a regional player, well, this is a victory. No doubt about it. In the purest possible terms, the United States has achieved its strategic objectives. We will have destroyed Iran's proxy network. Hezbollah is not even intervening. The Houthis are not making an impact. The popular mobilization force in Iraq is not doing anything. Hamas is defeated. They're a non-player. And Iran, after this, may have no military, may have no leadership. We just killed their leaders. And if we do that without losing a single life or piece of equipment, then the United States can claim victory. They can say, we did it. Mission accomplished. And what will then be the argument? Well, I can already see that a lot of people that are opposed to this conflict are talking about blowback, foreign wars, the cost, all these things are calling Trump a hypocrite. They say, well, there's going to be unintended consequences. Iran will turn into a failed state. They say Iran might retaliate with terrorism or missiles and Americans will die. And how's that putting America first? And they might say, perhaps this will cost a lot of money. And they'll say a lot of things in this category. But intellectually, we have to deal with the fact that this is not Iraq. It isn't. Iraq was a ground invasion. It was a true nation-building operation. It was true regime change. De-bathification, putting the culprits of the war crimes on trial, creating a new government security apparatus, a new political culture, and then having to maintain order between rival tribes and rival sects of Islam. And that cost a lot of money and a lot of lives. It took a lot of time. This is something else. If we bomb them into submission, this is going to be very light on the loss of human life on our side and in terms of cost. It's going to be marginal. It's not going to cost us, no, $3 trillion. And in the end, I think it's also not going to take as long to get what we came for there. We have to deal with this. Now, if that is the case, what's the argument? You can't just take the talking points from Iraq and use them about Iran. Why not? Because if you do, you lose the debate. If you have people hysterically screaming and saying, well, what about Americans are going to die? Well, what if no Americans die? What's your argument then? What do you say to Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin then if hardly any Americans die? And I know that sounds terrible, but if we destroy Iran's regime and, you know, maybe a dozen American soldiers die, the American public will look at that and say, that's worth it. That is what the American public will say. It's just true. And you don't have to like that, but that's the reality. And if in the end the cost is marginal, let's say we get what we want in a short span of time and it doesn't cost us even $100 billion. People are going to say that's a victory. People are going to say, you know what? This isn't nation building. This isn't costing us money. We're not dying for Israel. They're going to say we defeated a regime which actually is oppositional. They don't like us. They're Islamist. They're aligned with the other axis, with Russia and China. The American public are going to be susceptible to the argument that this is a great victory. So what do you say then? The hysterics are not going to work. The talking points are not going to work. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying you can't argue against this. I'm against this. But I'm saying we have to understand why we're against this. Why are we against regime change in Iran? Well, yes, a refugee crisis is a concern. Iran descending into a failed state is a concern. It becoming a hotbed of terrorism is a concern. The loss of life in Iran or on the part of Americans, cost, mission creep, all those things are concerns. But these are all probabilities and likelihoods. What happens if or when America just wins this one really hard? If it happens, well, then you need to understand the problem here. Why are we fighting in Iran? It's not about nukes. It's not about missiles. The reason that we were brought into this engagement is because Israel seeks regional hegemony in the Middle East. This has been their plan for decades and decades. They sized up their neighbors in the 1970s, and they looked at all of the Arab or Muslim or other countries arrayed against them. And they realized that if they wanted to truly be secure and safe and powerful, they would have to systematically defeat in detail, confront all of their enemies, destroy their regimes, and dismember their states. And only then would Israel be free to expand their territory, gain access to vital resources, and be able to secure its borders. And that's exactly what has happened. Israel has orchestrated over the course of 30, 40 years, the destruction of the regime in Iraq, the destruction of the regime in Syria. And regime change in those two countries created opportunities for Iran. Iran filled the vacuum. Iran is much larger than those countries, much larger population, bigger territory, ancient history, bigger middle class, more money, more oil revenue, bigger military. When Iraq went down, Iran came in and they backed Shiite militias there. And they gained a foothold in the country. It's called the Popular Mobilization Forces. And when Assad was weakened, not defeated, but weakened, it was the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, which deployed in Syria to fend off ISIS and the Kurds and all those other groups. And in doing this, Iran created a pipeline. They had personnel in Iraq, in Syria, and that connected them to their proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, which shares a border with Israel, but also the Houthis in Yemen, which they created and which they supported when they took power in 2013. This was the final battle. They took down Iraq, took down Syria, and then Iran, being the big one, having the bigger military, having the bigger population, having the superior everything, and creating this proxy network, this was their final rival in the region. Why did Iran want nuclear weapons? Because it recognized that if it didn't have them, the U.S. and Israel would take them out as they did Iraq and Syria. That's why Iran had a nuclear hedge. And that's why Iran had a ballistic missile factory. That is why they had this massive stockpile, because that was also part of their deterrent force. They knew it was coming. Israel stripped away their nuclear program, destroyed their missile program, so that now they can achieve what they always wanted, which is to topple the Iranian regime, so that Israel can expand in every direction. Think about it. Israel has made peace through treaty with Jordan, which is on their east, and Egypt, which is south of them. They are also treaty allies of Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates through the Abraham Accords. There is a lot of talk about Saudi Arabia being brought into the Abraham Accords as well. Iraq is a shell of its former self. The U.S. maintains a presence there, and they don't have a strong and powerful military. In Syria, after the Assad regime was ousted in 2024, Israel, or rather in 2025, I believe it was, Israel came in and destroyed all of the Assad regime's military hardware, leaving Syria utterly defenseless. Israel defeated Hezbollah and now is using U.S. influence in Lebanon to placate that country also. If Iran is out of the picture, all you have to do is take a look at a map. Israel will have no rivals. They are treaty allies with half of their neighbors. They have destroyed the other half. They have made peace through U.S. bribery and U.S. accords with Egypt, Jordan, Emirates, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. They have destroyed the regime in Iraq, Syria, and soon to be Iran. This is their ultimate objective. And what this gives them is unbridled, unrestrained, unlimited power. To do what exactly? Well, most likely to expand their territory. Without Iran backing Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, Israel can pretty easily push the Palestinians out of the occupied territories. Without having to worry about Saudi Arabia and its influence with the United States and that arrangement, Saudi Arabia's conditioned rapprochement with Israel upon Palestinian statehood, if Israel doesn't have to worry about it, again, they can push the Palestinians out. So what surely comes of Iranian regime change is that Israel first takes the West Bank, takes Gaza. Do they stop there? No. Why would they? Then they go in, as they are, in Lebanon, and they take southern Lebanon, south of the Litani River. And then they use that as a platform to go into southern Syria. And they go where the Druze live. They go down south, right up to the suburbs of Damascus, maybe taking a chunk of that. And maybe they expand south into the Sinai. Why do you think Egypt is deploying its military to the Sinai Peninsula and building tunnels there? They anticipate the collapse of the Camp David Accords and that Israel might seize the Sinai Peninsula. If Israel wanted to reach out then into Jordan, into Saudi Arabia, who exactly would stop them? The answer is nobody. What's more, with Iran out of the picture, now you have this all-important region, sea routes, overland trade routes. Think about the commerce that runs through this region between Asia, Europe, and Africa, through the Suez Canal, through the Strait of Hormuz. Think about all the energy in the Persian Gulf. Think about that vital highway between these continents where there will be rail and highways, where there will be plane routes, where there will be sea routes through these all-important choke points. This is the most influential region in the Eurasian African continent. This is the connector between the three. If Israel controls that region, how rich, how powerful can they become? Again, without being checked, without being restrained, constrained by any strategic or tactical imperatives because of rivals in their neighborhood? The answer is there's no limit. When Iran is defeated, they will have 300 nuclear bombs. No other country in the region has them. They will have a qualitative military edge, which is guaranteed by an act of the U.S. Congress. Do you know that? The United States can furnish other Middle Eastern countries with weapons, but we are bound by law that we cannot give any country more weapons than we give Israel. If we give Saudi Arabia F-35s, we got to give Israel twice as many. If we give Saudi Arabia the latest and greatest F-35, we got to give Israel something even more advanced. By law, we are required to furnish them. They are entitled to a qualitative conventional military edge with air power, missile defense, probably soon to be AI and other things. So they will have a nuclear arsenal. They will have the qualitative conventional edge. They are an intelligence superpower, and they are influential in the court of the United States. So in the end, if some other country becomes a problem, in the event that that's even possible, they can always call the White House reliably and we'll bail them out. And what we have effectively created here, this is the point, is a rival superpower. What we have created is a nuclear power with a very sophisticated conventional military and an intelligence apparatus, and we have handed them control over one of the most important regions in the world. Most important choke points, trade routes, energy, some of the most cash in the world. How much cash is in the sovereign wealth funds of the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris? That's all theirs now. And as the United States, or rather as the world order, undergoes a revolution, as China rises, India rises, as the world transitions from unipolar to multipolar, as we enter the age of complexity, of complex interactions between all states and all peoples and all states, who will benefit from the arbitrage? Who will be the ultimate middleman between China and the United States, between India and Pakistan, between Turkey and Greece, between Asia and Europe, between the Indian Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea? It's going to be Israel. That's the end game. So why are we against this conflict? For me, let me tell you precisely, why am I against regime change in Iran? It's not because of blowback. It's not because of mission creep. It's not because of casualties even or cost. Because all of those arguments, those might not work. Those things are genuine concerns. But in the end, that's not really the root of the problem. The root of the problem, my issue with Iranian regime change, is that we are creating an Israeli superpower that not even we will be able to restrain. That is why this is America Last. I wanted Iran to remain, not because I'm a Muslim, not because I'm a cheerleader for the Iranian regime, but because Iran balanced Israel. And balance benefits the United States. Why? Because it gives us leverage to put our finger on the scale. But if there is no balance and Israel has free rein, then where does our leverage go? They become a regional hegemon and they push us out. And then they are free to pursue an independent foreign policy and their own goals, and we will have no say in that matter. And that is not in our interest. So I wanted Iran to remain. That is a counterweight to Israel. And you know what? If Israel has a nuclear arsenal, maybe Iran should have had one too. Maybe the Ayatollah should have been building a nuclear bomb instead of writing about whatever it was, Black Lives Matter on Twitter. Maybe he should have built the nuke and gone all the way. What's the outcome now? But these are incompetent people, as we saw with Hezbollah, as we saw with Hamas and the Houthis. They were a paper tiger, and so was Iran, the source of them all. Maybe they should have built a nuclear bomb. If Israel has 300 nuclear bombs and they wage war on their neighbors and they threaten the United States, what's one more in the region to balance it out? At least then we could put our finger on that scale, as we do, as we have with other countries. That's my problem with all of this. And that's the bigger picture that people are not seeing. Israel has been on a mission. Just look at it. Look at how they have infiltrated the United States and how they wield the United States through our political system, through our financial system. Look at how they have used us like an instrument to achieve their goals, to empower themselves. They stole a nuclear arsenal from us. They got all of this military technology from us. We built their military. We defeated their foes. And now we have essentially handed this to them. Now they're ready to cut the umbilical cord and become their own superpower. We paid the price. We endured the cost. We paid the money. Our soldiers died. Our country burned so that Israel could grow stronger, so that a Israeli superpower could be born. And now our country will be in the wreckage. Not even a thank you. That's my problem with the war in Iran. So you have to get it right. And this is where we're going in the next 25, 50, 100 years. This is what we need to be thinking about. A world that is destabilizing, where there is a source of power. You have great powers in Russia, in China, in India, potentially Europe will get together as a coherent political unit. You have middle powers like Pakistan, Turkey, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, Ethiopia, Japan, that will play a role. And Israel, we just created another superpower. That's something we're going to have to contend with. And unlike those other countries, they have penetrated ours. So this is a problem. You know, we may be inextricable from this new superpower. They may come to completely dominate the Middle East and the United States, and then ultimately the world. That's it. That's the problem. So people said, Iran is threatening Israel. Iran is challenging Israel's influence. That's what they're there for. That is what they are there for. We want that. We want Israel to be weaker so that we can be more powerful over them and over the region. Now we don't have that anymore. So don't get it twisted. People are going to try and say, oh, well, there's going to be so much blowback. And you know what? It is playing into the hands of the Zionists. Because when the United States wins this war, without anybody really dying or without it costing a ton of money, when this is as successful as people need it to be to approve of it, all these people are going to look like idiots because they're all... Mark Levin and Shapiro are going to rub it in your face and say, oh yeah, remember when everybody said this is going to be another Iraq? Well, it isn't. So we need to be very clear-minded about what it is we have a problem with here. And the last thing I'll say about it, and then we'll move on, we'll take a look at Super Chats, is consider the role of the Trump administration in all of it. Consider his role. When Trump got in office in 2016, he did so with help from AIPAC, with help from Sheldon and Miriam Adelson. And that assistance came with a price tag. He was empowered by the conservative movement, which is a glove. I mean, it's a tool of the Israel lobby. And so Trump got into office and almost immediately he unilaterally pulled the United States out of the Iranian nuclear deal, setting us on our way down this road. Obama had made a nuclear deal to the chagrin of the Israelis. The Israelis hated Obama, hated the deal. Obama conducted the negotiations in secret, and the Israelis were not happy. They backed Trump. They wanted Trump to win so that Trump could undo what Obama had done, and he delivered. Trump ripped us out of the nuclear deal and set us down the path, unilaterally withdrew the United States, and then threatened Europe that if they didn't pull out of the deal, then he would put secondary sanctions on them. So they pulled out of the agreement. And then in 2020, Trump took the fight to Iran's proxies. He killed Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC, the architect of the proxy network. He designated the IRGC as a terrorist organization to increase sanctions on them. He put maximum pressure on Iran economically. After Trump left office in 2020, Israel went to work under the Biden administration, cyber attacks on Iran's infrastructure, assassinating their nuclear scientists, industrial sabotage, blowing up their oil refineries, their factories, their defense facilities. Do you know that Joe Biden was nearly going to reconstitute the Iranian nuclear deal in 2022? They're ready to go. And in 2023, just before October 7th, you might remember, Joe Biden had a prisoner swap with the Iranians. We gave them some of their prisoners. They gave us some of ours. We unfroze $6 billion in funds that had been frozen by us in South Korea. We were engaging Iran. China brokered a peace between Saudi Arabia and Iran. We were on a path to peace with Iran again. Trump tried to upend it. Biden came in. And what did the Israelis do? October 7th. And that whole deal not only was put on ice, but it went in reverse. And Israel began a campaign to systematically destroy all of Iran's deterrent capabilities. First, its proxy network, taking out Hamas and the Palestinians in the West Bank. Then confronting Hezbollah, toppling the Assad government and ejecting the IRGC, degrading the Houthis in Yemen. And then when they got Trump elected in 2025, they got what they always wanted, which was the strike on Fordo, on Esfahan, on Natanz to take out their nuclear hedge. And now it's the missiles. It could not have been done without Trump. Could not have been done because the Israelis wield the Republican Party. Trump told us the Iraq war was a mistake and we should have never been there and they didn't even have weapons of mass destruction. All this kind of stuff. And he gave them everything that they wanted. He utterly betrayed MAGA and the foundational pillar of America First, which is repudiating the legacy of the Iraq war. What does this tell you? It tells you that MAGA, the Republican Party, it's not a failure. It's a success. It is a roaring success. Don't kid yourself when you say Trump failed us. MAGA died. MAGA didn't die. This is what it always was. This is what it was designed to be, which is they came up with a conceit to trick people to vote for them by promising things they never intended to deliver. A border wall, mass deportations, reindustrialization. They didn't have a plan. They didn't have a clue. They weren't serious about any of it. But they wanted the Republicans back in the institutions. They wanted Lindsey Graham in the Senate. They wanted Project Esther in the executive branch. It was a Trojan horse. 10 years in, we are being told a border wall, mass deportations, tariffs. Well, we just can't do it. It's just too difficult because of the law, because of the Democrats, because of the media, because of whatever. But slowly but surely, the United States has assisted Israel in achieving their ultimate plan, which is toppling Iran and all of its proxies. So when they go in 2026 to ask for your vote, you need to remember this. Remember that the Republican Party is building Israel as a superpower while they kill America. While America is being killed by diversity and illegal immigration, by Haitians and Somalians and illegal Hispanics, and I know ordinary Hispanics too, I guess, and black people, all these problems that we have that Republicans don't do anything about. Where's our National Guard in the cities? Where's our mass deportations? Where's our Muslim ban? Where's our border wall? While they are complicit in the destruction of this superpower, the Republican Party is building a rival superpower that hates us, that hates us. So people go out and say, yeah, well, it's a lesser of two evils. Yeah, well, it's better than the Democrats. Is it? Is it better than the Democrats? I'm not sure. I think they're exactly the same thing. And I'm not voting for any of it. They're going to try to get you to vote for Vance. Where was J.D. Vance in 2016? Oh, yeah. He was working with David Frum, a speechwriter for George W. Bush. He was doing his Hillbilly Elegy tour sponsored by Peter Thiel, creator of Palantir, and he voted for a CIA agent groomed by Bill Kristol from National Review for president, Evan McMullen. That's who he voted for in 16. And you idiots believed him. He changed. He's a Trump supporter now. He saw the light. Now J.D. Vance says, well, we can't overlearn the lessons of Iraq. Not all military actions are a bad thing. The guy's a chameleon. He wasn't there in 16. We were there in 16 because we said the Iraq war was a mistake. We don't want Jeb Bush. We don't want AIPAC. We don't want Rubio, who Trump called the puppet of the Adelsons. We wanted America first. We were deceived and we were lied to. J.D. Vance was on the enemy team, and now he's right there with Trump. Now, take a look around. You're in the golden age Trump White House. You're at Mar-a-Lago. Take a look around at the new face of MAGA. In 2016, the face of MAGA was Trump and Ann Coulter and Jeff Sessions and Corey Lewandowski. That was the face of MAGA. It was Pat Buchanan. It was Sam Francis. That was the inspiration. That was the face of MAGA then. The face of MAGA now, look around. Mark Levin, Laura Loomer, Ben Shapiro, J.D. Vance. These are the big boosters of MAGA in 2026. Something has gone horribly wrong. All of those people, with some exceptions, were never Trumpers in 2016. Shapiro didn't vote for Trump in 16. Mark Levin was critical of Trump in 2016. Where were these people when the movement was actually born, when those pillars were in place? Now all of those people are in the center. The movement is something else now. And what we need in 2028, this is our last chance, we need in 2026 for this administration to be shut the fuck down. What does this administration do other than cover up the Epstein files, embezzle money through government contracts, and bring us to war for Israel? This administration needs to be shut down immediately. Do not vote in the midterms. And if you do, vote for Democrats. Fuck this. That is what the Republicans deliver. That is what our golden age looks like. The tariffs were refunded. The deportations were stopped. They wound down and withdrew the ICE from Minneapolis. What does this administration do other than embezzle money, go to war with Iran, and bury the Epstein files? Oh, and blackmail Harvard so they police anti-Semitism and ban people who criticize Israel from being in America. This administration needs to be shut down immediately. It has forfeited its mandate. They promised no new wars. They promised mass deportations in America first. And we're not getting any of it. So shut it down. In 2026, shut it down. And our only hope is that in 2028, in the Republican primary, somebody will emerge who will actually put America first. I am not voting for the vice president and the secretary of state that brought us to war in Iran. I won't do it. In 2016, I voted for Trump at 18 years old because Trump said the war in Iraq was a mistake. He said Rubio was a puppet of the Adelsons, and Vance voted for Evan McMullen, a CIA spook picked by Bill Kristol. I'm now going to vote for that ticket. I'm going to vote for the Rubio Vance ticket that brought us to war in Iran over my dead body. I would rather die than vote for that. So, in my opinion, 2026, shut it down. You got to burn the house down with them inside, metaphorically. And in 28, you better hope that somebody has a prayer to run the Trump strategy and do another hostile takeover over the GOP. Otherwise, I'm going to become a Democrat. Like, at that point, rather than be beholden to this country, that is our last chance. 28 Republican primary, we need a Trumpian figure to relight the candle. Someone needs to take the flame and take it further than Trump. He needs to take the baton and take it further and fulfill America first. That is the only way out of this at this point. And anybody that is not on this is not serious. The only takeaway that I have from all of these events, you are not pressuring this administration. All these people told us, if Trump brings us to war in Iran, we'll just tweet about it. Yeah, well, that's not really working, is it? We are locked in here. Here's what we can do. Never Vance 28. We can punish those responsible. We can make it clear. You failed to deliver America first. Your political career is finished. You will never be president off of bombing Iran. That is the message we have to send. Never Vance 28. Never Rubio 28. I'm not voting for the Iran war candidates in 28. I will not do it. And if it doesn't, if this animosity that we have, if it doesn't translate into that, then it will be for nothing. And they're going to try so hard to get you back on board. They're going to downplay it. They already are. You can already see the cope about this operation. But I was there in 2018, in 2016. Okay, I lived it. I lived the first Trump revolution. I wore the MAGA hat on the college campus. Okay, we got banned on Twitter. We got persecuted for this the first time. We are the OG vanguard of American nationalism. We have to make a comeback in 28, and we have to take our own side. We have to be the biggest, loudest faction, and the GOP needs to know they cannot, will not win without us, and we're going to let them fail if we have to. Otherwise, you are not serious. If you're not serious about letting the Epstein, Iran war, administration, and presidential ticket fail, then you are a sucker. You might as well go sign up to flick the lights on and off for them on Saturdays at that point. If Ben Shapiro wouldn't vote for Trump in 2016, if he was willing to let Hillary Clinton win, then we better be just as willing not to vote in 28 for the person that betrayed Americans and brought us to war in Iran. And if you can't do that, again, you have no right to be a free people. You have no right to be sovereign. That's the difference. So that's the situation in Iran. It's so shameful, so disgusting. It's a war of choice. Iran does not threaten us. Got no business there. This was a decision. And it was a decision made by another country for another country's benefit. They will get the glory. We will pay the price. We decrease. They increase. They are delighted to consign the American empire to destruction while they look forward to a golden age, while they look forward to a century of empire and domination. Maybe we can't stop it, but I'm not going along with it. Maybe it's biblical. Maybe it's prophetic. I'm not going along with it. I'm never worshiping the God of Israel. I'm never worshiping the Moshiach who they think is coming next. Christ is my Lord and Savior. He is my God. America is my country. I may not be able to stop this agenda, but I sure as hell am not going along with it. I'm not fucking voting for it. That I will not do. And that's it. But we're going to move on. We're going to take a look at our super chats. We'll see what you guys have to say about all this. And then I'm going to get out of here. It's my weekend, for crying out loud. I was saying to myself, thank God it's Friday. And now, you know, here we now the world has just changed forever. But that's the rallying cry. Never Vance. Never Rubio. We have to tell everybody, you know what? I'll tweet it out right now. I'll tweet it out right now. And you guys got to go and you got to be the brigade. You got to let them know. Okay. Everybody get ready to retweet this. Okay. Let's see. All right. Now, I should have had something ready, but I'm tweeting this out now. Everybody smash the retweets. This needs to be the narrative, okay? Never Vance, never Rubio. This is our program. We're not going out in 26. I will not reward this administration. They can't pass the SAVE Act. They can't massively deport people. They can't shut down H-1Bs or they won't. They won't release the Epstein files. I'm not giving them Congress. I'm not giving them the Senate. Good luck. Ask Netanyahu. You want votes in 26? Ask all those free Iranians. Ask the Israelis. I'm not voting for it. And in 28, never Vance, never Rubio. It's got to be somebody else. Otherwise, we're just playing games here. Otherwise, we're fucking around. That's got to be the message. You just lost. The MAGA movement has betrayed itself. Its fundamental pillars are in shambles. No border wall. We're at war with Iran. Forget it. The only thing I will accept in 2028 is America first. Dark America first. And this is the final battle. This is going to be the most important election of our lifetimes. We are either going to have America first or we are going to destroy the GOP. It's that serious. We're not voting for lesser of two evils. We're not doing it. 2028 is the most important election of our lifetimes. I am never Vance. I am never Rubio. I will never vote for the Iran war ticket. It is America first or it is nothing. America first or nothing. You either become America first or the GOP will be destroyed and I will cheer for it. I may go to the gulags too. I will go to the gulags happily if it means the traitors are not in power. And that's the take it or leave it mentality we need to bring to the table. They're going to say everything about us. They're going to try to fuck with us. They're going to try to get us to stand down. You're not immune to propaganda, but you have to tune that out. This is how we flex American power. I'm sick of Jew power. I'm sick of Israeli power. I want American power. But that starts with taking control over our vote. That's the message.